Coming up on Digital Music Trends 185, recorded on the 28th of May 2014, the Worldwide Independent Music Network versus YouTube, Apple's 3 billion bid for Beats, although of course the actual announcement only came about 5 hours after we taped the show, so more on that in the next episode. I chat with Lyricfine's CEO about their recent deal with UMPG, Audium expands beyond YouTube, analytics company Next Big Sound branches into books with the Next Big Book, Billboard launches real-time charts powered by Twitter, and we also briefly discuss TunePix and the DJ too. Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends. I'm Andrea Leonelli and this is the weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry, and DMT is available as an audio and a video show on a variety of channels, including the iTunes Store, most podcatching apps, including Downcast, YouTube, SoundCloud, Mixcloud, and also you can check us out on TuneIn Radio, and we have a newly looking page there, which is pretty cool. And if you'd like to receive a weekly mail out on what's going on at DMT and about the latest shows, you can sign up on bit.ly/DMTlist. Again, it's bit.ly/DMTlist. And don't forget that DMT needs your feedback. And if you'd like to comment on a story or point me in the direction of a story that we haven't covered in the last couple of weeks, please email contact@digitalmusictrends.com or tweet at @DigiMusicTrends. And this week, I'm super happy to welcome Vicky Norman to the show. Hi, Vicky, and thanks for joining me. How's it going?
It's great. It's great. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And Vicky has worked in the digital music space for a long time after spending close to 5 years as president of North America for 7Digital and is now working on her own consultancy. Am I correct?
Yes, that's correct.
That's great. Thanks so much for joining us. And unfortunately, we had a third guest lined up, but he was called away on a school mismatch of calendars. So totally understandable. But I think it's going to be a bit of a respite for our listeners, because I was mentioning to you, Vicky, that the last couple of shows have been well over an hour. So hopefully we can wrap this up a little bit quicker. And it's going to be a bit of a respite for those that are finding it hard to follow the entire show all the way through. But there is quite a bit of stuff to talk about this week, and I actually wanted to start by talking about Vicky, your experience. You've just come back from Music Matters in Singapore, and a very exciting conference, lots of great speakers, and so I wanted to start by asking you about what your impressions were of the event, and if you saw any particular trends or elements of discussion that are concerning specifically the Asian market, maybe, or the global market that you've seen being really strong and present at the event.
Yeah, it was a great event, and I'm a veteran of Music Matters. When I was working in Asia, I went to the first five in Hong Kong, and it's a really well produced event, a really great way to get your head around Asia, because that market is really, really complicated.
Right.
But it was a good event, and the I do have a couple of observations, and one of the I think the most profound one for me was that when I was doing work in mainland China and in the broader Asian region in 04 to 07, it was really, really early days. And right. it was probably too early for any kind of commercial music business in digital to be there. But the time seems right now, and there's some really interesting statistics that I learned when I was over there about, you know, the Asian market is 3.5 billion for recorded music, but Japan is 3 billion. So yeah. So there's, you know, I think the general consensus, and listening to Max Hull of Universal Music talking, was that right now for Asia the money's in Japan,
right.
And the market has definitely stumbled and had some difficulty, and it's still largely physical. Japan was one of the first out of the gates with mobile music because all of the labels cooperated, but now for streaming and other kinds of capabilities, there's, you know, the market really in Japan really needs to have a pretty big overhaul,
right?
To keep that domineering position.
And we talked about it on the show as well. We were talking about the fact that it's been really hard for services to license the music because of the internal players that are not allowing companies to actually get hold of the tracks.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's very closed. And so I think that this is, and we've seen this over and over again in the industry in general, when there are a lot of legacy players, it's really, really hard to break that open.
Yeah.
but the view is also looking at China and looking at some of these areas where there's a leapfrog situation happening where there wasn't necessarily ever a CD, a viable CD recorded music market. There wasn't necessarily even any downloading in China,
right.
And except for ringtones and ringbacks, that's always been really viable. But the hopes that there's going to be a new economy around streaming, which actually makes a lot more economic sense.
Of course.
There.
Yeah, and hopefully, I've heard a lot about new reforms in the law around copyright and things that are being processed in a very big bureaucracy that is China. If it all comes through, it actually looks pretty rosy as far as new ways of implementing copyright law and the state actually getting involved in that.
Well, it is fascinating because publishing was a really big part of a lot of the conversations that I was having over there. And there aren't legacy and entrenched players, sometimes there may be some publishing laws or collection laws, copyright laws, but there's no actual way to, no mechanism to collect.
Yeah.
On that. And so I think there's a really good opportunity for some of the systems to be set up from the ground up for the streaming economy. It's not going to be easy, but certainly having to untangle things is always a lot more difficult than just building them from the ground up.
Yeah, and of course, Ed Peto with Outdustry and Thomas Raymer from 88 to C88 are two of the sort of only people that I really know that are based in China and really sticking it out and try to make it work over there. So it's going to be interesting to see how those companies fare and how the whole ecosystem develops. And as far as the smaller markets like Indonesia, for example, the Philippines, was there anything around that? Did you overhear anything as to how those markets are developing?
Yeah, it's really fascinating because as we've seen patterns in the entire world where each country is really developing differently, in the sense that in the West, we certainly saw like in Sweden and Norway, streaming has proven to be an absolute economic boom to the music industry, putting it in the right direction. But markets where downloads have always traditionally been strong have had a little bit more difficult time getting streaming to take hold.
Right.
And the US is a good example of that. In Indonesia, it's another web of different countries developing differently. And Indonesia, for instance, is a really, really strong BlackBerry market.
Right.
And so it's in Indonesia, it's where, people, wait in line around the block when there's a new BlackBerry phone coming out, which is something that we often forget about here. but each country is really developing differently. But one thing that I learned that was also really fascinating is that, for a number of years, a lot of the labels really pulled back. The major labels really pulled back from the Asia Pacific region because they didn't understand it. The relationships have to be very long standing. There are carriers. There's just a completely different way of doing business. And now all three of the majors have the heads of the Asia Pacific region headquartered in Australia. Which is really fascinating because we've also seen the Australian market go from having no streaming services to having 15.
Yeah.
And
that caused a few issues.
but it is at least opening up because Australia was another market where it was largely iTunes dominated 5 years ago. And now there are a lot of new companies that are entering with exciting new streaming services. So I think the fact that Australia has become a little bit of a hub for some of the decision making for Asia Pacific region is actually good because there probably will be a bit more learning and hopefully that means that the major labels will be moving in somewhat of the same direction around Asia.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And hopefully we'll hear a few more reports. I know Billboard wrote a few reports from Music Matters, but hopefully some videos or something will surface in the next couple of weeks around the conference. Yeah. I hope next year I'll be able to make it. I tell myself that every year, and then it never works out. So it's let's see what happens next year. And it's a long trip to Singapore, right?
It is a long trip to Singapore, and but once you get over there, I think that it's such a great event because there are a lot of self-selection criteria going on where people are flying from all over the world to get to Singapore. Yeah. And once they're there, they're really open to doing business. There were a lot of international people there this year, so
That's
it's great. Right.
That's awesome. And talking about the worldwide music industry, I guess we should break into the first news of the week, and that is around the Worldwide Independent Network, which is an organization representing the independent industry worldwide. They decided to go public with a statement condemning YouTube's practices in the negotiations with independents over the upcoming YouTube music streaming service in particular. So we heard a few grumbles in the last couple of months around the YouTube rates, specifically around the streaming service from independents, but now we get an official statement. YouTube is said to have already reached deals with Universal, Sony and Warner, but not with the independent sector. So Alison Wenham, Wins Chairs and the CEO of AIM, which is the Association of Independent Music here in the UK, released a statement, and I'll actually read this in full. It might take a minute or two, but I think it's pretty important to have all the facts here. So she said, "Our members are small businesses who rely on a variety of income streams to invest in new talent. They are being told by one of the largest companies in the world to accept terms that are out of step with the marketplace for streaming. This is not a fair way to do business. Wynn questions any actions by any organization that would seek to injure and punish innocent labels and musicians and their innocent fans in order to pursue its ambitions. We believe as such that these actions are unnecessary and indefensible, not to mention commercially questionable and potentially damaging to YouTube itself, given the harm likely to result from this approach. The International Independent Music Trade Association call upon YouTube on behalf of their members to work with them towards an agreement that is fair and equitable for all independent labels. This has uncomfortable echoes of a similar behavior by MTV 10 years ago, who chose initially to take a similar approach in undervaluing the independent sector, but who subsequently concluded a deal on fair terms, which lasts to this day. It is for every company to determine their own commercial arrangements, but it is in no one's interest to see independent artists being undervalued in the digital marketplace." So Wenham's sentiments were echoed by lots of different heads of independent music organizations around the world, including Rich Bangloff from A2IM, for example. And this is really an interesting position to take, because if they came out with this public statement, it kind of feels like there's really a roadblock here in the negotiations with YouTube. And this service that YouTube was rumored to be releasing already in Q4 of last year is really delayed at this point. And it's going to be hard for YouTube to release it before they manage to get a deal done with the independents. So, do you think that this kind of drizzle that has started to envelop YouTube on the independent side over the last few months is becoming a bit of a storm at their end? And how can they deal with it at this point?
Well, it's really hard, because I think that the independent, if you put the three majors and then all of the independents in a bucket, when you look at the independent music, it becomes really unwieldy, because there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of labels. But it's really essential, especially when you start looking internationally, because the independent music is really where it makes the difference in terms of local repertoire. So you have to get it, you have to do it, and you have to do it right. And we've seen increasingly organizations like Merlin and others that have banded together and have been able to show the economic value that the independent labels are bringing to services. That statement's really, really strong, and I think that the independent labels have a right to be able to stand up and say, no, these terms are unacceptable, and we're not going to accept anything that you pass across the table to us. But I also think that independent music, it really should be put into a couple of different buckets, because there's truly independent bootstrapped, bedroom guitar players who are uploading music and distributing it that may or may not have much commercial value.
That's your TuneCore, your City Babies, and yeah.
Exactly. And in YouTube, I don't know, you know, I would imagine that it, like a lot of other streaming services, that it's kind of a superstar economy. So the better known artists are going to rise to the top. But I don't think that, I don't think that it's a very sophisticated view to put all the independents into one bucket, including self-released artists, as well as other, independent labels that are like beggars group that are just, you know, absolutely at the forefront. And so, I think that there's more work that needs to be done in educating a lot of the technology companies about how to engage with the independent labels. And I think a lot of them, it's an afterthought. They get their deals done with the majors, and then they just think, oh, those guys are just going to come along, and they won't.
I mean, the interesting thing here is also because of the reaction by a number of different independent organizations worldwide, it also makes me wonder how extensive YouTube is seeking to make this service. Like, you know, a lot of services start out just being, you know, US centric, or US and maybe UK and a couple of other territories in Europe or Australia, for example. But here there's so many organizations that are listed as sort of adhering to this statement and saying that they are also experiencing the same problems, that it almost feels like YouTube is trying to go worldwide right from the get-go. Like, that would be really disruptive, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think all eyes are on YouTube right now to see what they're going to do, how that service is going to impact, what that's going to mean to the funnel of YouTube. And I think one of the most interesting things about it is that, you know, YouTube is free, it's accessible, anybody can click on a link and share a link, and there's no, you know, I don't need to subscribe, you know, and be able to get all my friends to subscribe, and all of those gating items that have limited other streaming services being able to freely share that. So I think the devil's in the details a little bit on what YouTube is, you know, what the impact of this is going to be, and how stuck in the licensing tar pit they will be before they can actually get something legal out the door.
Yeah, exactly. And without forgetting that, of course, whilst YouTube is the largest streaming service in the world in a sense, it also doesn't have a precedent when it comes to this type of streaming service. And so, you know, it has a huge amount of leverage, which is why it managed to get deals done with pretty much everybody, including Merlin and a lot of publishers, when it comes to the actual YouTube service. But when it comes to the streaming service, I think rights holders are very wary of repeating the same mistake in giving YouTube that leverage. So I think now that YouTube has to play by the rules because it doesn't have this sort of DMCA style, approach that can help it in the negotiations, then I think right holders are going to be a lot more, demanding in the rates that they're given. And so that's going to be... It's going to be a fun one, I think.
Yes, exactly. I think so too.
Yeah, last time we talked about it, the reports were that YouTube was probably YouTube itself leaked it as it being a problem with the product itself, that they were trying to figure out a way to display tracks properly and giving a visual element to tracks that don't have videos, for example. But I think that also hides the fact that they were having serious troubles on the licensing side they couldn't really get the service off the ground. And we had another rumor on the Apple Beats saga. I feel like I should have some sort of like a jingle now at this point, an Apple Beats jingle, because it's been going on for now 5 weeks. The long debated acquisition of Beats Electronics and Beats Music is reportedly going to happen, according to the New York Post, and will be announced this week. Again, we don't know if that's going to happen or not, but I hope it won't be in the next 10 hours. Otherwise, the podcast is going to be out of date by the time it comes out. And so the New York Post states that the purchase price has been reduced by $200 million to $3 billion, which is still a very good price. And it's likely that the reduction was linked, at least in my opinion, to a revaluation of Beats Music, since according to the reports that were leaked in the last few weeks, Beats Music has only got about 111,000 subscribers, in spite of the companies and AT&T's efforts to market it to a mainstream audience. So, that might have been the case. It might also be that Apple reduced the price out of spite for Dr. Dre's perhaps inappropriate videos stating that he was the first hip-hop billionaire in a fairly raunchy way, which is not really Apple style. So, Vicky, can I ask you what the sentiments were, aside from these rumors that, of course, we can't really substantiate in any way? What kind of sentiment you felt there was towards this acquisition, if any, at Music Matters? Have you heard people talk about it? And what is your take?
Yeah, people were definitely talking about it, and there was a lot of head scratching, quite frankly, and from people who were running some of the streaming services, some of the rights organizations, and I think there's general speculation of the headphones actually really make a lot of sense,
right?
Because they're the best-selling headphones. Apple already sells them. They have an iconic look and brand, and you slap some app Beats by Apple or that type of thing on it, and it really fits with the portfolio of what Apple has. Now, the question of, well, couldn't Apple build high quality headphones if they wanted to? And I think the answer certainly is yes. But this jumpstarts them. I think it also puts them in the right, it puts them directly into the right demographic and in a younger urban market, and they don't have to build that brand. It can augment their own brand. But the interesting thing about Beats is that I've always maintained, from when I worked at Sonos, I got to learn a lot about the, channels and channel conflict, and, and Beats having both the headphones as well as now a music service, that kind of introduces a lot of channel conflict into places like Amazon and Apple, where they have competing services. I also believe that if Apple wanted to build an on-demand streaming service, they could certainly do that.
Right.
And so I don't think that any of this is probably like, one side of this acquisition is the killer reason. I think it's a mix of a lot of them.
Yeah. And it's been also said that, that Apple may have wanted to acquire a third-party service so that it could keep the two separate for some time while it tries to understand how it can phase in streaming and phase out downloads.
Yeah. Well, it is fascinating, because when they launched their radio service, I think that one of the I think they intended it, or it certainly seemed like it from a product implementation, that they really wanted that to be very tightly integrated with purchasing.
Right.
But what really happened is there was somewhat of a cliff, and that when they started that, the people just stopped purchasing. And so then I would imagine they're probably looking at that and saying, okay, well, how can we better monetize this? Because, you can't monetize free very well. And Apple already has all of the consumers, that are using their devices in their ecosystem.
Yeah.
But I think the other important element to this that there was a lot of discussion in Singapore was around, Apple post Steve Jobs. And Steve was really a visionary, and he very much had his, eyes as closely focused on brand and entertainment and culture as he did in industrial design and, shipping great products. Whereas we don't necessarily see that with Tim Cook. He's a supply chain guy, and he's really, really much more of an analytical thinker. And so there was a lot of speculation when I was in Singapore about whether this was the, also a big acqui-hire of getting Jimmy and Dre and artists and more of the creative side of it back into the Apple world. I could kind of argue that either way. But I think there's some merit to that. And I do remember at South by this year during the iTunes Festival, there was an Interscope showcase,
right,
which I thought was really interesting, because that wasn't something that I would see as typical.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. And, that's the interesting thing about this story. I think I could argue equally well a point for Apple buying Beats and a point against Apple buying Beats. So I think at this point, we're just going to have to wait and see how it shakes out. I mean, from a perspective of somebody who's worked for a service that was primarily focused on downloads for a long time, how scary is it to the industry? We've talked about this a lot on the show in the last few weeks. How scary is it for the industry, the prospect of Apple shifting to a stream model from downloads?
Well, I think it is really scary, but they're also late to the game. Now, I think that the biggest advantage Apple would have is that they have by far the lion's share of consumer accounts in the world, where people have the ability to purchase on their phones and very seamlessly integrate into their phones. But I think that I think that the, you know, the ability to get a streaming service to have a lot of traction, the ability to build a great feature set and really get a sticky user experience, it's hard. It's very, very hard to do. And we've seen so many companies try that and fail. Yeah. So I think, you know, Beats Music is just barely out of the oven. And I actually think 111,000 subscribers, that's really not bad for the length of time that they've been live in the marketplace. But I think that the world is looking at streaming as the future for the global music industry. And, you know, having Apple jump into it, I think is probably something that solidifies for everyone that there is going to be streaming and subscription as, in the marketplace for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, absolutely. And, last week, moving on from the Apple Beats story, last week, Lyric Find announced a very interesting new deal with Universal Music Publishing, so UMPG. And I actually caught up with the Lyric Find CEO, Daryl Ballantyne, last night. He was in Tokyo, so we couldn't do this live on the show today, unfortunately, to hear all about it. So here it goes. It's a real pleasure today to welcome the CEO of Lyric Find, Daryl Ballantyne. So hi, Daryl. Thanks for joining us. How's it going?
It's going great. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you.
Glad to join you.
And you're all the way from Tokyo, so thanks for making the time. I know it's late your end, but I wanted to chat to you about a deal that was announced this week. So your deal with the Universal Music Publishing Group. So can you tell us a little bit about that and how it came together?
Sure. Well, we've been named as the sole third-party company able to license Universal Publishing's lyric rights.
Right.
So they'll still be able to license directly, but anyone wanting to go through an aggregator or someone other than Universal directly, we are now the only authorized third party able to license that. So it's obviously very exciting for us and a wonderful honor for them to choose us.
Sure, and you've been working with them for a long time, right?
Yeah, we've been working with them since probably 2006 was when we first did a deal with them. They originally opted into our first deal with HFA for the U.S. only at that time, and then we expanded worldwide probably 2009.
Right.
And now we've done the exclusivity deal, so it's pretty exciting. It came together, started off in the fall. Universal sent us an RFP saying that they wanted to have a single provider to license their lyrics, and how would we like to work with them on that, and what would we offer, and what type of cooperation would there be?
Sure.
And so then we went through a long selection process and a lot of back and forth, but in the end, they chose us as the best provider out there.
And it's great because, of course, you know, you provide them a back end of tech that they wouldn't have themselves, and also the relationships and everything else.
Yeah, it's a combination of the technology, both the APIs and the royalty processing systems, and also the data, the lyrics themselves that someone like Universal doesn't have.
Yeah.
Most publishers don't. In fact, virtually all of them don't actually have the lyrics themselves.
The interesting thing is also, from an international standpoint, you have quite a big expertise. You know, you're present in over 30 different countries, and that must be a massive headache as well for a license holders to try and track those royalties and how they all split off in different tangents when they go internationally, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a massive headache for us, too, but it's part of our service and our reason for existence. So it is certainly very complicated, and we track royalties on a country by country basis and usage by country and the ownership splits by country, which turns into a huge data problem that Mohammed, my co-founder and CTO, has to deal with constantly.
Right.
Luckily, I don't have to sift through all of the issues that come up there, but he and his team go through all of those headaches and make sure that everything is properly tracked and accounted. Yeah. And that system on its own is highly, highly complicated and data and computationally intensive.
Yeah, sure. And so looking at the deal itself, you know, do you think that, you know, is this something that you'd be open to work with other publishers along the same lines if the opportunity came up?
Sure. I mean, we're always open to exploring it and discussing that with publishers. It's not something that we put a lot of thought into before this when Universal proposed it, but yeah. It's definitely something that we would be willing to explore.
Yeah, sure. And so going back to something that came up a couple of months ago whilst we're here, I wanted to ask you about the work you're doing with Bandpage right now. So can you tell us a little bit about that and how you what kind of synergy you're looking at here?
Sure. Well, the Bandpage deal is a really interesting one for us in that it helps a lot of our clients to monetize their service and provides additional content and the ability to build in useful content for the users of their service.
Yeah.
So what we're doing with Bandpage is they have a service called Bandpage Experiences where they're aggregating potential like one-on-one or exclusive experiences with an artist, whether it's a backstage meet and greet or doing a Skype call with an artist, or maybe it's exclusive merchandise or all sorts of different possibilities like that that create really intimate relationships between an artist and their fan. So we've integrated the feed of that content and those experiences into our service so that our clients can connect to the Bandpage service through us and see what are the relevant experiences for a particular artist when somebody is viewing the lyrics or on related pages, and offer that content and those experiences to their users. And if somebody comes through and buys one of them, then our client, whoever's displaying that content, gets a revenue share on that and earns some money to support their service and obviously support the artist. Most of the money goes back to the artist, of course.
And it's really interesting to see how there are so many different avenues to monetize lyrics when you look beyond, you know, the standard, you know, ad-supported sites. So that's quite fun.
Yeah, and if you look at someone who is viewing a lyric page, they're generally somebody who is much more interested and much more of a fan of the music than just a passive listener.
Right.
So something like experiences are much more likely to appeal to them than the average person listening to radio and it's just on in the background and they don't have a particular attachment to that artist or those types of situations. So we really feel that people who are looking at the lyrics are a much more active and avid fan of a particular artist.
That's great. Well, Daryl, thanks so much for the update on Lyric Find. It was well overdue, and I hope you have a good stay in Tokyo.
Thanks a lot. It was good to talk to you again.
And Vicky, you know, talking about Lyric Find and the world of lyrics, but also of music publishing, it was interesting to hear Daryl talk about the fact that UMPG needed, you know, Lyric Find to do a certain number of things. And also, a lot of publishers don't have a full database of their own lyrics. So there's a lot of confusion around rights. So did you hear anything around that on Music Matters? And how do you feel that publishers can solve these problems around databases? I mean, I experienced the same thing when I was trying to license large catalogs for music publishers. It was really difficult.
It's really difficult. It's really, really difficult. And music publishers are sitting on a mountain of really important rights. But they don't necessarily have all of the pieces that they need in place to be able to actually make those rights useful in
right.
the marketplace. And that includes metadata that can be matched to the sound recording metadata, and it also includes the actual lyrics. And you know, I've known Lyric Find for a number of years, and I didn't know that they had to make up, you know, and actually annotate a lot of the lyrics that they have, because the actual lyrics just don't really exist anywhere.
Yeah, it's interesting. it's a very fragmented industry, and it's always funny, like, even to hear of a major publisher that doesn't, you know, all the contracts are still on paper, there aren't centralized digital databases, so there's so much work that needs to be done on that end. And I guess because their income streams have been relatively protected so far, there hasn't been too much investment going into building that infrastructure. But hopefully in the next few years, we're going to see a lot more of that happening, especially in the offices in LA, where you're right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think UMPG in particular, they are, you know, they're really trying to wrap their heads around what the future opportunities are. And yeah. I think they were one of the very first publishers when I met with them, when I first started meeting with publishers when we were doing licensing for on-demand streaming, that that they, you know, immediately said, you know, we feel like we're leaving a lot of money on the table right now.
Yeah.
And it was actually really good to hear that, because it's true. But I also think that there's a really, really deep problem around things like metadata, which are not easy to solve. And I certainly hope that the more UMPG starts getting involved in licensing new models and really embracing that they'll serve as a leader.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you're talking about leaving money on the table. And one of the stories that I want to talk about today, I actually tried to get Jeff on the show, but I don't think he could make it, was Audium. So Audium has announced the expansion into publishing administration. So the company was started as a way to ensure that, you know, publishers and labels and artists recouped all the different types of royalties that might be due to them on YouTube. But now Ed Christman at Billboard reports that the company has started offering music publishers the ability to audit, administer, and license interactive scan and match lockers and other hybrid digital music services, which include Spotify, Google Play, iTunes Radio, and Match, Audio, Deezer, Rhapsody, Beats Music, MediaNet, and Move Music. So Jeff Price stated that the existing mess of missing and bad data has misallocated or stopped payment of hundreds of millions of dollars owed to music publishers and artists. The trick to finding and collecting money in the new digital music industry is matching metadata point database architecture and copyright law. By fixing this problem, we're able to find, unlock, and administer a huge amount of money our customers would otherwise not have gotten, all while removing liability for the new music services. So Audium developing an interesting technology that is really raising a lot of heads. They managed to get a decent round of funding in from some really interesting people. They got a lot of clients already going for them. And so do you feel like this, you know, at the beginning, some people were arguing whether Audium was just a gimmick, whether the technology was actually there, but it really feels like there's a lot of momentum behind the company. And do you think that we're going to see some copycats also coming into the market? We've seen a few already.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Jeff is exactly right. I think there is a lot of money being left on the table. I also think that I like to talk about the music streaming services as being the most beautiful house that you can imagine walking into, and then the plumbing is just the most atrocious leaky plumbing imaginable. So you're running the water upstairs saying, wow, this is beautiful, and then it's just everything's leaking out. And so there's there's money that is not able to be paid out because you can't get 100% licensed on a song, and you need all of those rights to fit together. So I think it's really smart. And I met another company when I was over in Singapore, and it's a Russian company that they've built an application called Heaven 11. And it's also a matching service, and it's something that they started in Russia because there actually wasn't a society to collect and pay out anything on the publishing side. And so they started it up, and I got a demo of it, and it's actually really great.
I think
when you look at what Audium is doing, you look at new companies that are coming into it, and then you also look at CSAC's recent bid for HFA.
Yes.
there's a lot of room. There's a lot of room in that side of the business to clean it up and with better technology and start patching those leaky pipes.
Yeah, and it's going to be incredibly interesting to see how this bid from CSAC on HFA goes. This was announced on the 23rd, which was just a few days ago, actually. And HFA, of course, is the Harry Fox agency, and it's one of the only organizations actually that holds aggregate data on publishing information for tracks. There's probably like another couple of companies that do similar things, but HFA has got a very extensive database on that. So you can actually go to them and ask them, who owns, this David Guetta track or whatever, and they're going to be able to tell you the different publishers that have them, and they also have some split information as well. This would be actually interesting because HFA has been relatively independent, although it was under a number of different bodies. In any case, I think it's closely related to the NMPA as well. But to see it go under CSAC, it would be interesting because we don't have other organizations that are doing similar things. So it becoming part of a collection society, it's a bit like, when was it Google? When Google acquired the other company that was doing something similar?
Oh, Rightsflow.
Rightsflow. That's right. Mm-hmm. And suddenly that big database wasn't quite so accessible. Of course, CSAC is a collective organization, so it's a different thing. But I don't know. Do you feel like that it could really affect the access to information or not? And also given that the global repertoire database that we were all hoping would happen is not happening right now.
Right. The GRD is stuck. It's out of funding, and I was at this WIPO sponsored roundtable in Kristiansand in Norway, and it was all about the GRD and the MRD and trying to get a single registry to identify all of the songs. And on the one hand, that sounds absurd, but on the other hand, you think about every computer that we have in the world has an IP address, has a unique IP address associated with it. There's really no reason why this isn't being done. But I think that with HFA, I think what I've seen there is a company that has steeped in the old world. And they are making really, really great efforts to become much more modern in the way that their database operates and the way that their, the way that their systems work. But it's really hard. And so I think that what we've seen over and over again is companies that are set up in the music space and they serve an absolutely critical need in a period of time. And then the market changes. And it can be a mix of their business model, it could be a mix of their technology, or it could be just the mix of the approach of how they see the world. Yeah. And they no longer serve that purpose. And I have to commend CSAC because I think that for them doing this, I think that they're one of the, one of the collecting organizations and performing rights organizations that also has recognized that if they don't do something and change, they're going to become irrelevant.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, I really do applaud it. Whether it will really be successful and technologically proficient enough to be able to match the needs in the marketplace is another question.
Yeah, sure. And just to dive a little bit deeper into the story for the listeners that are interested, the HFA is owned by NMPA, the NMPA. As I mentioned earlier, it was established by the NMPA to begin with. And the bid is rumored or considered to be between $30 and $40 million. And so it's going to be interesting to see how this shakes out in the next few days, but it might take a little bit longer it's not a straightforward tech acquisition, so timelines are not quite as quick as we might expect when the rumors are that Apple might purchase Beats and then it's stuck for 5 weeks.
Well, there's also floors and floors of filing cabinets and boxes of paper in the Harry Fox offices, and so you think about that, like that's not your typical tech acquisition. you're going to acquire quite a robust collection of file cabinets and paper.
Yeah, exactly. And although I couldn't see any filing cabinets at the office floor I visited on Wall Street last year, I think, when they just moved. So they must keep them on different floors. And so I wanted to talk about what do we want to talk about? Actually, Next Big Sound, it's quite a big news from them. They announced that they've launched a new venture called Next Big Book. So the name kind of says it all at this point. The company is expanding from its music analytics service to serving the book publishing industry. And they've been working with Macmillan's for the past 8 months to develop a service that has adapted to the needs of the book publishing industry. It makes a lot of sense. I was actually pondering with some friends maybe South by, we were wondering, where is Next Big Sound going? Because now they have deals with almost all the big players in North America for analytics. And so how can they grow scale-wise? How can you scale a company when it's already got deals with so many people? A vertical expansion makes complete sense, where they can move the same analytics into different industries and just adapt them to make them relevant to the book industry in this case. So do you think that this was the right move? And can you see them moving into more sectors after that?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, and I think most companies that work in music are always looking to diversify because it's tough when you have a supply chain that's as problematic as we have with music labels and PROs and publishing organizations. But I think that a data company of all is probably the best position to be able to go into another vertical. Because with licensing and with rights acquisition, I think what a lot of companies that have tried to go from music to adding film and books and ebooks and other kinds of things, I think that what they've found is that these industries are all really, really quite different in terms of how they license their media types out, what kinds of windows, what kind of constraints they have, their pricing mechanisms, the amount of control they have, the number of outlets. So I think that has proven to be a lot harder than most companies anticipate on the actual licensing side. So I've always been an advocate. Yes, you need to diversify, but you may not be very successful about it, depending on how your company is architected.
Yeah.
But I think on the data side, I think there's actually a lot of merit there, because the book industry, music has definitely been the canary in the coal mine in digital, and you look at what's happening with books and with Amazon and the power that sits between the actual book publisher and the retailer, and some of the new services that are coming out that are all you can eat and that are subscription type services. They need to better understand their digital consumers and how they're behaving, so that they know which kinds of levers they should be pulling in. Yeah. Their licensing and their offers.
Yeah. And also, like, the booking industry feels to me like the most similar to the music industry when it comes to the actual granularity and volume of releases, in the sense that you have all the way from the major book publishers to authors that are self-publishing on Amazon. You have this huge breadth of potential customers there. And differently, I guess, from the movie industry, in the sense that the movie industry, as much as you have a lot of independent filmmakers, you're never going to have as many independent movies being released as you have independent books, just because of the constraints of and the costs of the medium and everything else and the time required to put it out. So in that sense, it makes, in my mind, it makes a lot of sense to go into books, because, you really have millions and millions and millions of potential customers there, and a few huge players that could land you big contracts. So good luck to them. I'm really excited about it. It's really tough when you get to that stage. A really established company, you have a great tech, but you are stuck to one vertical. You're like, what should you do? And and we saw that actually with CD Baby. CD Baby actually managed to do pretty well out of the opening of Book Baby. So that's another company that's managed to diversify into books that way. And finally, the last big story that I want to talk about was Billboard and the new real-time charts in partnership with Twitter. They were announced just a few hours ago. The first is called the Billboard Trending 140. It makes sense due to the characters of the tweet, which measures the most shared songs in the United States by acceleration over the previous 30 minutes, with the ability to go back and look at the trend over the past 24 hours. The second chart is the Emerging Artists one, which, according to the Billboard's FAQ includes new and developing artists who are defined as those who have fewer than 15,000 Twitter followers and have not yet appeared as a lead artist in the top 50 songs on the Billboard Hot 100. So I looked up the definition just because I thought emerging
artists. That's interesting.
Yeah, emerging artists is always a hard category to define. So I thought I'd better actually look it up and see what they are defining it as. And for both charts, there will be a weekly roundup, which is going to be published on Billboard Magazine, of course. And Billboard will be picking up on a variety of different sources in terms of tweets. You know, it's difficult to figure out when people are talking about a track, of course. Again, I looked up the FAQ, and it says that it's going to be tracking links to tracks shared from several music platforms, which include Spotify, Vivo, and iTunes at the moment. They will also track the use of the Now Playing or NP hashtags and other similar hashtags with the name of artist and track name in the tweet, and then they're going to consider that as part of this chart, and also the use of various terms associated with the song and song playing. This is more obscure. It says such as music, song, track, listen, but I guess that would have to include the track name and the artist name as well for it to count. I'm not sure. So these new charts actually seem deliciously hackable in the sense that you know, we've seen a lot of artists doing sort of Twitter unlocking campaigns to make sure that their hashtag was trending, and if there is a chance here to actually get nab a spot on a Billboard chart, I can imagine a lot more artists wanting to get into this game of getting fans to actually you know, specifically at a specific time release a number of tweets with the track that is being shared and make sure that that artist climbs the Billboard chart. So what do you make of this, and do you think that it makes any sense, you know, or is it too easy to hack?
Well, it does seem like you could game the system, doesn't it?
Yeah.
but you'd probably have to have enough of a critical mass of followers and you know, and people that were engaged in order to do that. So I guess
so in that sense, maybe you deserve it, right?
Right. There's a little bit of control there. I mean, I think it's really interesting that Billboard and Twitter have come together on this, because I think that, you know, Billboard is such a legacy, legacy name, and it has such a brand identity with music. But the Billboard charts don't mean the same thing that they did, and that has certainly evolved. That has certainly evolved over time. I'm not 100% sure what this would be measuring, though. And I think that when you think about the Billboard charts, you know, it was about sales, and it was about the, you know, music really, really rising to the top over a period of time. And I'm not sure we're a short attention span culture, but it's what the last, you know, trending in the last 30 minutes. I mean, that's really crazy. And how would an artist manager or a label or a self-managed band really act on that? How would they
right.
say, okay, you know, how can you make that meaningful? How will that translate into plays on a subscription services or purchases or vinyl or buying tickets and touring? And,
yeah.
And I think that what we've seen with music over the years is that the artists who can sustain some level of critical and cultural awareness over a period of time are the ones that can actually build a viable career.
Right.
And so just having something that pops into people's stream of consciousness, and then it goes away. I'm not sure how relevant that would be, but I kind of like the fact that they're doing it, because it certainly puts Billboard more into our current society than it is right now.
Yeah, exactly. And I have a couple of points of that, actually. You know, on the one side, it benefits Billboard, but it also benefits Twitter. Twitter, as we know, considered buying SoundCloud last week. The deal didn't happen, but it definitely shows that Twitter wants to get more involved into the music in the music business and keep being relevant within that music demographic. Also, it's going to be interesting to see in the long run, because this is being done and the tech is being put in place to track this, how we're going to be able to model that data and look it up against the sales data, like you were mentioning, and gig tickets data, and see if there's any correlations and how the Twitter mentions influence those things, even if it's a thing that you can only do, posteriorly, after the event, unfortunately. And the third thing was actually, I was thinking about press releases, because I get a lot of press releases from PR companies that are saying, you know, our artist got to the number one of the singer-songwriter iTunes chart in the UK, which is, again, it's a time-relevant chart. So it could have been that the artist was only there for, a day or even a few hours, whilst all the fans bought the release at the same time. And I'm worried that this is going to happen with the Twitter chart, where all the PR companies are going to start adding, and our artists reach the number one or the number five or the number seven on the Billboard Twitter chart, and you're going to have no notion as to for how long that was, whether it was just for the 1 30-minute interval, right, or for a longer period of time. So,
yeah. I think that's actually a really valid point, because I think everyone is struggling to find some way to quantify what they're doing in the marketplace, because it's not always money. You know, money is hard now, and it's very difficult to say, oh, you know, music sales, or that's a single identifier. It's not really radio airplay, because radio airplay is, you know, terrestrial radio is, you know, that plays a role, but not the only role. And now Twitter is something that is another, you know, another mile marker where bands can say, oh, I achieved this, but what does that really mean? And I certainly hope that there's some data around that of what it actually does mean to, if you rise to the top of Twitter in a particular country for a particular period of time. Does it matter? Yeah. Does it really matter?
Does it really matter?
But I do think that Twitter is, you know, more and more, it's a, you know, is what we've seen with a lot of the, you know, social networks, where, you know, it starts out being about me learning about you, and, you know, and friends and people communicating within a network. And as, you know, as these companies go public and as they become very big, they have to monetize. And the way you monetize is to really develop channels where you can put advertising around that. And the more that Twitter knows about what kinds of music that people are really listening to and where a particular artist has a demographic, then they can serve ads to that. Yeah. So that's probably where all of this is going. But I bet you will be inundated with some more press releases in the near term.
And there is one more major story, but I'm going to leave that till next week. Hopefully I'm going to be able to get some legal advice on it as far as the implications of it and how it's actually structured. And it pertains to Universal Music essentially filing a couple of summary judgments motions on Friday that seek to put an end to a number of artist-led lawsuits that were actually aggregated into one class lawsuit that claimed that the label should have been paying them royalties for digital downloads as if they were licensing rather than sales. And there's a bunch of different legal points that I'm not going to go into right now, but that's a really interesting story, and hopefully I'm going to get somebody next week from the US legal side of things that can help us make sense of that, because there's so many caveats, and I don't want to misinform anybody about it. And there's a couple of more quick stories that I wanted to go through. Vicky, I'm going to zoom through them. If there's anything you want to comment on, please just jump in and stop me, and we'll get right into it. And so first of all, there's a new app called TunePix that received a big feature on the Apple Store, at least here in the UK. I'm not sure about the US. It had a lot of press. They had even two pages booked of advertising on Wired, as somebody pointed out today on Twitter. And the app is essentially an Instagram that allows you to associate photos with songs. So you take a photo, you associate a song that's already in the database, there's a clip of the song playing, and away you go. You browse your feed, and the songs start playing automatically when you get to the photo of that a friend has taken. And interesting take, interesting concept. I'm not sure whether that's any more than a feature within a service or a company that's maybe aiming to get acquired, or whether it can actually become a service in its own rights. I'm not sure.
Well, I know, I've been so deep in the world where you're trying to marry a great idea with something that's licensable.
Yeah.
That consumers are going to care about. And I have always been under the assumption that the music labels and the music publishers view anything where music is running with images as a sync license. And that's a very different license than just running, you know, and having preview clips. And there have been a number of very high profile companies that have had games and things that are running on preview clips in iOS, and they've had to take those down, completely dismantle them. So I read that article as well, as and I thought, well, you know, that doesn't really say whether or not they checked the legal fine print on that, but I think it's a good idea. I think it's something that's really natural that people want to do. Whether it's its own service, you know, is up for grabs. But I think that people like to express themselves, and they say, "Wow, this is the best sunset I've ever seen," and it reminds me of this song, and they want to put those things together.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure if I get the guys at TunePix on the show at some point in the next few weeks, I'm going to ask them about that as well and put them under pressure a little bit. And also a new app, a new version of DJ called DJ 2. It's an app for iOS, has been released. The updated app behaves similarly to an app that we actually talked about a few months ago, back in March, that was called Pacemaker, that allows users to access and mix Spotify's 20 million tracks as a DJ, essentially. You know, DJ 2 also has two decks, and you can sort of scratch and do all sorts of stuff on the tracks. And the app also includes an auto mix feature, which is now powered by the Echo Nest Music Intelligence Program, which makes a lot of sense because the Echo Nest is owned by Spotify. And so the company managed to get a deal done with Spotify, then it's all good. Of course, the users need to be premium users of Spotify in order to be able to use the tracks. And Vicky, again, once again, a question of licensing here, because ever since I saw the first app, Pacemaker, I was wondering how they got away with it, because it starts to be quite an interactive use of the track that is seems to be a little bit beyond. Of course, you can't record any of this. It's all like sort of ephemeral, but at the same time, it does allow you to do quite a lot with the track that perhaps sort of starts threading in a gray area.
Right. And there are lots of these gray areas that in music licensing, where you may look at this, you say, well, in DJ culture, you can mix and scratch and sample and do a lot of different things with a sound recording, but in digital, to create an application around that, you get into a very, very big vortex of interpretations of rights. And I think that from my own experience talking to lots of different labels and publishers, I think there is a, you know, there's a growing sentiment that a lot of labels and artists feel like, well, why not? You know, if it's going to help my music rise to the top of 20 million songs,
and if it helps adding users to the premium service of Spotify as well.
Exactly. It's fun, and it seems very culturally relevant. But I think that it's always the outlier of, do you actually know who thinks it's okay and who thinks it isn't okay? And if it's just a simple cease and desist, we don't think this is okay, and remove my song, is that sufficient, or are you going to get yourselves into a lot more trouble than it's worth? But I think the fact that it's coming from Echo Nest and Spotify Premium, I think that gives it a little bit more of a ring fenced safety zone.
And of course, it has to be added also that, you know, given my conversation with Andreas from Spotify Business last week, I would imagine that none of this has commercial licenses attached to it, of course. So a DJ wouldn't actually be allowed to use this app as part of their set, which is a very important point to make. I'm not sure whether, that's probably going to happen anyway, but because unless you get a company actually trawling through clubs and looking at DJs' iPads to figure out what version of Spotify they have, it's going to be hard. But I don't think this is meant, this is not meant for public performance. It's just for fun. So we're going to see how that
shakes out. And I think from that perspective, I think it's great, because the thing about music is that when it reflects, when everybody can be in their bedroom, singing into a hairbrush, and they can be their own rock star. I mean, that's what music has been to many, many people. And now, instead of that, it's DJs, and it's bedroom DJs, and it's people who are really affected by electronic music culture.
Yeah.
So I think it's great, and I think that one of the more heartbreaking things about a lot of these apps that are coming out is, they're there are little bits of functionality that are in or out that can make an enormous difference in whether their licensing costs are small, medium, or large. And it may not make any difference at all to the consumer.
Yeah.
They just want to play around with it. And the nice thing about building an app within a Spotify environment is you do have a lot more interactivity and a lot more room to play than if you're trying to do it as a standalone.
Yeah, absolutely. And finally, Moogfest seems to have lost $1.5 million in the last edition that just happened. Billboard spotted that the festival added this information as part of a grant application, which was denied, actually, by Buncombe County. And Moog asked for a grant that was three times the size of the one received last year, equivalent to $250,000, and was denied. We're going to see what happens to the festival next year and how they're going to be able to restructure it in a way that they don't lose so much money and they can keep it going. And finally, Hypebot reports that a service called Ximalaya, which appears to be a Chinese version of SoundCloud, has received $11.5 million in VC funding. The information around the service are pretty spotty and sketchy, but it's going to be interesting to see how that develops, given that there appears to be a Chinese version of almost every other major social media site from the US or Europe. So why not SoundCloud? It makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It does actually make a lot of sense. And I think that there's, within China, you don't just drop an international service into China. It really doesn't work. I mean, we saw what happened with Google and after Google pulled out, what it did to Baidu.
Yeah.
Just that company just exploded. And I think with music, I think that this is actually a really important one to watch. Now, because it's uploading and because there is, some semblance there of user-generated content, that is, if China wants to build some sort of a legal marketplace in digital music, I think that this will be one that they'll have to have some sort of controls and mechanisms in place. But most of the money that is going to be made in China, I think, is going to be coming through telcos and different kinds of services and probably the high profile Chinese artists. And so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But that's definitely one to watch.
Absolutely. And Vicky, it was an absolute pleasure having you on today. I've had a lot of fun recording the show, and I haven't done a one-to-one in a while.
Yeah, it's great. Thanks for having me.
And so can you tell us a little bit more about what you're up to at the moment, and anything, if there's anything you want to plug at all, that's your time to do it.
Yeah, well, I've been, as you mentioned, I spent 4.5 years, I started up the 7Digital business in the U.S. and got, did that on my own for 2 years and then incorporated a U.S. entity, have a small team. And I just really was ready for a change. And it's a tough business to be in, of sitting in between technology companies and labels and publishers. But there are a couple really great services that I personally worked on that are not yet live in the market. And over the next couple of months, they should be rolling out. And I think there are definitely some to watch because they're quite differentiated than any streaming services that are out there right now.
Awesome.
And I'm excited. Tommy Silverman invited me to come to New Music Seminar. So
nice.
I'm going to go out there, and it's actually really fun for me because I feel like there's so many problems that people are trying to solve, and there's so many exciting things that are happening in the marketplace right now. Yeah. And so I'm going to try to really take my time before I jump into anything in my usual 120% way, and see who's doing what out there.
That's awesome. Well, again, it was great fun, and thanks so much. And thanks so much for listening to the show today. Once again, you can find everything on digitalmusictrends.com, and don't forget to check out the one-to-one show, which also comes out weekly, and where I interview an interesting digital music company or an interesting project that is happening in the space. You can tweet us on @DigiMusicTrends if you had any comments on what we talked about today, or if you'd like to point out new stories, you can also email on contact@digitalmusictrends.com. Thanks again so much for listening. Have a fantastic week, and till next time.